My name is Preeti Sri Venkatram. Today is the 16th of September, 2022. I'm conducting an interview online over Zoom with Ms. Sumaira Abdulali. She is currently in her home in Mumbai, and this is an interview for the Making of Indian Conservation Project. Thank you again for agreeing to be a part of this interview. And we could probably jump right in with the first question that I have for you, which is, given that your professional life has overlapped with a large part of the period that we're interested in, I'd like to ask you about how you feel your work has intersected with India's conservation journey over the past 50 years. Perhaps you could reflect on how you see your roles and responsibilities and how you view their relevance.
Well, over the past 50 years is not a time period over which I've been working. Mm-hmm. But certainly I observed what was happening because of my family, who were very active in the conservation movement. Mm-hmm. My father-in-law wrote the first draft of the Wildlife Protection Act. And he was, since he was also distantly related to me, I saw that. And I also, because of Salim Ali, we grew up with wildlife very much part of our daily lives.
He was also a relative.
Yes, he was also a relative. Mm-hmm. And he lived also, both of them lived when I was young, very close to me. Mm-hmm. I also spent a part of my childhood out of the country in Japan. So these things came to come together. You know, the Japanese are very nature loving in general. The aesthetics form a big part of their lives. So these things in combination mean that although I, of course, was not active 50 years ago when I was 10 years old, I grew up with it for sure. Mm-hmm. And it's only much later, as like in about maybe 25 years ago or so, mm-hmm. that I started taking a more active part, something I had never thought I would do. So mm-hmm. I've been able to address what I did after about 1998.
Okay. Would you want to share a little bit maybe about what it was growing up with such stalwarts, if that's the correct word, at home, I mean, in immediate vicinity?
You know, we never thought of them as stalwarts because they used to visit us and they were just uncles, you know, who were around. And they used to hang around with those binoculars around their necks. We accompanied them quite often, my father-in-law, Humayun Abdulali, of course, to the national park, which was very accessible in those days all the mm-hmm. time. You know, we sometimes went out on weekends when I was a bit older. So we didn't think of them as stalwarts, but they used to talk about birds and wildlife all the time. Okay. And the, you know, in those days, making these video documentaries was in its very early stages, and Salim Ali made some videos mm-hmm. of wildlife, which we had never seen before. We had not imagined that you could see these things on video. Mm-hmm. So it used to be a big grand affair in my grandmother's house. He would come and he would put on these videos and then we would watch them, and, you know, on a big screen on the wall, everything had to be cleared. So it was like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think we thought of it as anything in particular very unusual. We believed everybody was like that.
I see. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You were wanting to share something about when you started work, I think, in the 90s?
Yeah. So I started, had never thought that it would be something I would work on. Mm-hmm. Because it was, you know, something that others did, my relatives. But I noticed a road which was blocked in Kihim, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And by that time, my father-in-law was quite old and Salim Ali had already passed away. Zafar Fateh Ali, another uncle, was there, who was another conservationist. But he was old too. So they kind of asked me to help, and I started helping with that. And then by and by, I noticed sand mining on the beach. So
What year would this have been?
I started work around 1998. But the sand mining thing I'm talking about was in the early 2001 or two. And I succeeded in some of the things I did there, but I also had very young children at the time. So I decided that I didn't want to work so far away. You know, you have to constantly go travel, and I didn't want to neglect my children. So I decided I would take up something in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And another uncle, Saad Ali, who was a freedom fighter and also at that time chairman of one of Mumbai's, or actually the Mumbai's first environmental action group, the Bombay mm-hmm. Environmental Action Group. I asked him for help, and he was working on noise pollution.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked if I can buy free. And that's how it really started. And then there was a sand mine.
Sorry, the connection was a bit...
I decided I will not work outside.
Unclear. Yeah. I lost you at when you mentioned that you asked him he asked you for support when it comes to noise pollution?
Yeah, he asked me to help because he was also very old. You know, all of them had kind of, you know, it was beyond there. So he asked for help in drafting the noise pollution case. And then he asked for help in actually signing it. He asked me to sign it. So I did.
Mm-hmm. What was this case about? Could you share a little?
Yeah, his case was about the noise pollution rules had come about in the year 2000,
mm-hmm.
and they restricted noise within certain decibel limits, and also beyond time at night, beyond mm-hmm. 10 p.m. and 6 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
There could be no loudspeaker use. So he had a marriage hall next to his house, and he was very disturbed because they never kept to the rules. That was one part. The other part was that he had been very active in a committee which had been set up by the Bombay High Court called the Sujata Manohar Committee, Justice Sujata Manohar Committee. And that committee report and his suggestions to and objections to the draft noise rules
mm-hmm.
in 1999 formed part of the rules which were notified in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
In 2002, the government had issued an amendment to the notification allowing loudspeakers to be used for 15 days a year between 10 p.m. and midnight.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to challenge that notification and also ask for better implementation, which was not happening at all. So I helped him do that. I thought it would be initially, I thought it would be some clerical work. He would, you know, I would just help him with paperwork. But then suddenly he asked me to sign the petition because he couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And
but what was the work that you were involved with before you started?
So I said yes, and then I found myself signing this petition and learning about things which I knew about in a way, but I didn't know about in a large way, because I knew nothing about the law or how it functions or what the courts are, and I knew no lawyers at all.
Mm-hmm.
He introduced me to Shyam Diwan, who was, you know, who took up the noise pollution case initially. At that time, he was junior. Now, of course, he's a senior advocate in the Supreme Court. So it was a learning process, and I found myself more and more involved as time went on. I found that we got a very good order, which nobody had expected we will be able to get. Although we had put in the prayers that there should be no loudspeakers in silent zones, which are the most affected areas, in the areas next to hospitals, next to schools, where people are impacted very directly. We did not really think that such an order was really possible, given that noise is so pervasive everywhere, you know, in India. And the general feeling at the time that it's unavoidable, and anyway, Indians are used to it, so it doesn't affect them.
Mm.
So we got the order somehow, and then I realized that the order by itself would not be a sufficient. And the lawyer who had helped me file the petition, Ishwar Nankani, said to me that if you don't do something or the other to get this order implemented, then all the pro bono work that all of us have done for you will be wasted. So under his encouragement, advice, whatever you want to call it, I very reluctantly gave my phone number to the first journalist I had ever met in my life outside the High Court courtroom. And she published my number on the front page of the Times of India and said, anyone who has noise complaints, call this number.
I don't know what happened next.
And it was in the festival season. So you know what happened next. I got so many, many, many calls that it was really impossible. It was really, and my phone rang all night for days and days and days without stopping. I didn't sleep. I would get some sleep in the morning hours when people calmed down for a bit, but that's about it. And my husband said, you know, what's happening? I mean, are you ever going to switch off your phone? And I said, no, I can't. So I kept a record of all these calls. But one thing which I learned with those calls was that this generally thought statement, which even I had believed, that Indians love noise or that they're immune to it, is not true. Because people would cry on the phone and people would say things like, we know you can't help us, but at least you're not telling us that we are the crazy ones for being so impacted. So I realized, and until then, really, I had thought, well, you know, I'll do this, but who knows how much time I'll spend on it, you know, how long I'm going to continue, stuff like that. But after I started hearing people's stories, I knew that I have to do it, you know. And those calls, which started at that time, continue till today. At least I would say there's hardly a day which has gone by when I haven't received at least one fresh call. And that is after the police received so many calls initially and through the years that noise pollution complaints have become the highest recorded complaints on their control room number. And the second highest crime recorded filed under the Environment Protection Act after wildlife crime. So it's become something people have used, and they have, of course, had to set up their systems. There have been multiple court orders after that, and I have become kind of committed to figuring out how to take this forward. Not always easy, but, you know, there's been a lot more awareness. Even when I say awareness, people generally think awareness means that you, someone stands on a banner and holds a placard. But to me, awareness in a city like Mumbai means, first of all, Mumbai leads sentiment in many ways across the country. So awareness in Mumbai means awareness across the country. And it also means awareness of professionals who contribute in various ways. And I'm talking of lawyers. Ishwar Nankani has worked pro bono for me, including bearing the expenses and costs of filing all these multiple court things since the beginning. And it's meant people who work in different spheres, you know, people who understand campaigns professionally, people who understand all kinds of different, of course, schools, colleges, other NGOs, and the government and enforcement agencies. So people make up all of these areas. And if people feel for it, that includes their professional expertise being brought to the table. And that's one way that Awaaz Foundation has been able to function, which is an NGO I set up years later, has been able to function almost completely without funding, except for project funding, because people have worked pro bono, which I think is such a better way to do it than to gather funding and then pay people who will do various things, the same things, because the people are doing it out of their own passion and commitment.
Could you share maybe when you set this foundation up and what actually precipitated that?
Yeah, I set up Awaaz Foundation in 2006 because before that, between the time that I started receiving these noise complaints and my decision to set up Awaaz, I had also taken up, in spite of my having said that I'm not going to do any issues outside the city, I had seen sand mining happening on this beach where I grew up, Kihim Beach. And I had tried to complain and been brushed off. And then I had been told by the collector of that area that I should catch the sand miners red-handed, which everyone knew was a dangerous thing to do. And I had told the collector that it's strange that I have to catch them red-handed because the entire village knows who's mining sand. But since you don't. So the next time they were mining sand, which was nearly midnight on one particular day, no one knew I was in Kihim on that day because it was a weekday. And I went and I stopped them and I was attacked. I was hospitalized. And so again, you know, when something happens, you have to decide whether you're going to do it or you're going to give up. So I decided I want to do it. And I had filed, I had wanted to file a petition against sand mining because I had tried to find out information and figured out that there was really almost nothing available in the public domain. And I had taken photographs, which is just about all the information I had at the time in various sand mining sites to show how damaging it was. But I didn't want to file it as an individual. And I also realized that it was important that my noise pollution work should also have a better framework. And so I set up AWAS in 2006 and filed this petition on sand mining and another petition on noise from traffic and construction and other things, which had been left out of the first petition, in the second noise petition.
And then what was the work that you took forward related to sand mining?
Well, sand mining, well, we had some court hearings and in about 2009, 10, and early 11, we got a number of orders. The first very good order was to ban coastal sand mining because of the policies which did not show what kind of destruction was really taking place. Then other people started joining because, you know, one of the things that happens when you get a court order is that you, the press picks it up because it's something said by the court. And people start calling you, just like happened with noise, it also happened with sand, that people started calling me from various rural areas and complaining about sand mining, which gave me much more information as to what is, you know, where it's happening. And soon after the order banning sand mining in coastal districts, because I had primarily been working on beaches and creeks, I got a call from someone in Mahad who said that the court says no mining in coastal districts, but in Mahad, which is a coastal area, it's a creek, sand mining is happening all the time. So please come and have a look. So I went there and I was attacked again. This time I was nearly killed in a in a car, in an engineered car crash. And so that's what happened, basically.
What makes you keep going once such a thing has happened?
I think it makes you more determined. Because, you know, I didn't die. I'm here to tell my story, unlike many other people who are not here to tell their stories or are unable to, even if they're here. So I think it actually makes you more determined that, yes, it's not this non-entity issue, this which no one cares about. It's important. It has a meaning. It you know, it's worth doing. So it actually made me. And there was another thing which happened around the same time, that there were applications for helipads in Mumbai on private building rooftops.
When would this have been?
2010. And I attended a meeting where one particular application was being discussed. This was a public meeting. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that it was kind of decided, it appeared that way in the meeting, that they will allow it. So I recorded noise levels from helicopters landing and taking off at the Juhu airport, just outside the Juhu airport at someone's house. Mm-hmm. And gave those readings to the court. So data is very important, right? Even in noise, it's the data which really makes the difference of whether or not you can do something. Mm-hmm. You know, getting a vague court order that noise should be controlled or saying noise, this is the way noise should be controlled, mm-hmm. hinges on data. Mm-hmm. So the noise data which I collected was among the first citizen science campaigns which were recognized by the courts and by everybody as useful to policy change. So similarly, the noise data which I took of the helipads was submitted to the court, and the Pollution Control Board took that data and verified it by conducting their own test. And in fact, the levels they found were even higher, because their meters perhaps were might have been more able to record, split-second moments as well. So based on that, I also wrote to the Union Environment Ministry, and they banned private helipads on private rooftops across the country. So that was a, until now, although a number of private helipads have been constructed on important buildings, private residential buildings, they have not been used.
Okay. But they've still been allowed to...
They were allowed to be constructed before all these hearings.
Yes.
The building was allowed, everything was allowed. The question is noise, which was never considered. In fact, the hearing I attended was for the noise pollution. Does anyone have objections? And of course, everyone living in the area had objections, because at 128 decibel levels, you have to stop all other activities on a rooftop. And in Mumbai, a rooftop means that there are other buildings very, very close whose windows are next to you, right next to you. And they don't always have sound insulation sufficient to take care of this kind of decibel level. So a rooftop, we are unable to tackle traffic on the ground so far as noise pollution goes. Where's the question of tackling traffic in the air? And particularly when the air traffic control mechanism does not take into account noise pollution at all. They're not able to control it around our airports. Are they going to really think of noise pollution when they chart flight patterns, flight routes, landing times, takeoff times, how many times you're allowed to land and take off? Are they going to keep track of noise pollution? And I think the answer is no.
And I just want to know, this work that you do, such as data collection, do you do it all on your own? Do you have a team, or how do you go about it?
So, Preeti, it's like this, that if data has to be stand up to scrutiny, as in a court of law, I think it's very important that I am able to do it myself so that I can prove that this is something I have done, and I can file it under affidavit, that this is to my personal knowledge. So far as some part of the data goes, I've done it myself since 2003. And that remains as a very valuable record of this time. However, because noise meters are expensive, I was fortunate that I was donated one in the early days, which I still use, and has been calibrated and checked even against the Maharashtra Pollution Control Board meters as being accurate. Because everybody has a mobile phone, you can download a free app on your phone. And there are many such free apps which are usable. But there is one particular app called Noise Tracker, which is developed by NIRI, which is a government body. And so we recommended that people use NIRI's app and complain to the police. And the police accepted it. We made a small booklet quite recently, actually. We made a small booklet, and the police commissioner released it, and he has accepted that people who complain using this app, the complaints will be treated as valid. So anybody and everybody can record noise. You need to take a screenshot. You need to post it on the police Twitter account, and that's your record.
Maybe I can ask you, as we move into the next part of this interview, if you were to reflect on the past 50 years of environmental conservation in India, what would you say would be some of the major successes and failures, in your opinion?
Well, I think Project Tiger is a very important step that we took, because we protected very large parts of natural areas. And at that time, it was quite far-sighted to do that, because there were so many of them and tigers were everywhere. And of course, when I say tigers, I don't mean just tigers. When you protect an area, you protect the entire ecosystem of the area, down to the last ant and spider and, everything else in it. So in the name of the tiger, we have protected some parts of very much larger areas which existed in those times. So I think that's been a major success story. We have also, because of our history, we have a lot of traditional interaction with nature. You know, because nature has given us traditional medicine, it has given us water, it has given us. So we have in our tribal community a huge repository of information and experience about how to live with nature. So in the name of tribal welfare, we have protected other areas which are not tiger areas as well. And I think all of these are important. What we have not protected is areas which we don't recognize as being. So we have recognized forests, which are important, very important. But we have not recognized adequately grasslands, for example. We have not recognized beaches for the most part. We have very few marine national parks or protected areas. So we have taken the tiger and we have taken tribals as two core reasons for conservation, for preservation of an area. And in the process have preserved and conserved many other things alongside. But we have not taken other species. For example, if you look at the coast and you take corals and dolphins as being important, then you would have a whole host of other kind of protected areas. Or if you take beaches as being important for conservation, not for tourism, and I'm drawing a distinction there, for conservation, this has not happened. And I think that's something we really need to understand and catch up with. Maybe this is the time to look forward and figure out that grasslands and beaches and marine areas and other things which scientists and, you know, local living people will be able to identify are also important to conserve. Water bodies, lakes, rivers. Maybe we need to have conservation areas around rivers. You know, the whole river is a conservation area. These concepts don't exist because we look at rivers as a water source.
And when it comes to like the two areas that you have particularly been involved with, noise pollution and sand mining, in terms of those and the past 50 years or how much your professional life has overlapped with that period, what would you say are some successes and failures when it comes to these two issues?
Well, not both of these issues were not recognized at all. No one had heard of them. No one was willing to take them on board. And in fact, I was laughed at more often than not. Mm-hmm. But from there, both these issues have been recognized. They've been recognized locally, state-wise, nationally, and now internationally. I presented the issue of sand mining for the very first time ever to the United Nations in 2012 at their Convention of Biodiversity, which was held in Hyderabad in 2012. And the UN did not have even one document on sand mining at the time. They said that although coastal issues are among their most important, they have never heard of sand mining. And thereafter, I participated in a documentary film called Sand Wars, which was shown in France and Germany and impacted sand mining policy in the EU. And thereafter, in 2014, the UN took it up, came out with their very first paper. In 2018, they held their first round. I wrote to them saying that since in India at the time was the nation where the COP was held, that we should take the lead in controlling sand mining. And this was sent to the UN. And I also said that they should form a subject in the international discourse on climate change and on biodiversity because sand mining affects both. But nothing happened until 2018 when the UN held their first roundtable. I gave the keynote address virtually before lockdown. It was since it was in Geneva. And then they came out with their first report on sand and sustainability, and the United Nations, the UNEP, took it on board as and passed a resolution as part of their mineral resources governance paper. And that was the first time ever. And now the UN has been doing various things with sand mining. It's been recognized. It's been talked about. There have been other documentaries and films made. There have been numerous articles across every international paper but all of them, one or many of them, in one way or the other, feature India. Because in India, India is the country which is using, between India and China, more sand in the last 10 years than the West has used in the entire 20th century. And that's because we're building at unprecedented rates. And we have neither any kind of information about how much sand stock we have, and when we announce building projects, how much it's going to use. So we are unable to draw a correlation between the two. There's a lot of confusion between what is legal and what is illegal, because licenses are given and the conditions misused. We don't have the manpower or the ability at this moment to either quantify the sand or to control the illegal sand mining, which happens under cover of legal sand mining very often. And government and police officers have been killed in this process. Of course, other activists. So it's an issue which not that many people want to work on a hyper-local level. Still, there are some. And so I'm glad in a way that the attack on me, which was what was reported, not the issue of sand mining initially, led to all this greater increased awareness. I think sand is so obvious because it's everywhere that it's one of those things people just take for granted. You know you need sand for building, but you don't really stop to think where it's coming from or what's happening along the way. And what is happening is that you're destroying rivers, beaches, creeks, marine environments, biodiversity, and accelerating all the events of climate change that you'd want to talk about. So that's sand mining. So far as noise pollution goes, again, I've told you I started very reluctantly. I took it up because I felt for the people who were talking to me, you know, asking for help, which I felt inadequate to provide. But along the way, it's been this, and that this actually, strangely enough, has become international even later than sand. Maybe because, again, maybe it's not such a pressing issue in other parts of the world. But as late as July 22, the UNEP executive director made a statement, maybe one of the first statements at that kind of level, that noise pollution is directly related to species loss and climate change. And it's the next big issue after air pollution, which needs to be taken up, because noise pollution impacts people's health, but not only people, but all species, all living beings. A recent study which studied 100 species showed that even a caterpillar's heartbeat speeds up when it's exposed to noise. It affects migratory patterns of birds. It affects mating patterns of many, many animals, and lockdown has provided a clue to us. And of course, dolphins, which have been recognized as non-human persons in some parts of the world, and other such intelligent mammals, marine mammals, are very impacted by noise in the oceans. Every animal, starting with our pet dogs and cats and all the wild animals and birds and everything else, is impacted too by noise. So I think we are yet to see the true extent of how noise and climate change interact, but I think we're beginning to see that.
And so much of your work has also revolved around activism, and you mentioned there was two attacks on you, and I know you set up something called the Movement Against the Intimidation and Intimidation Threat and Revenge Against Activists, MITRA. So I was wondering if maybe you could also reflect on the relevance of social justice to conservation if you were to link all these aspects together.
Well, I mean, they're so closely linked that you can't really extricate them, I think. But we tend to talk in silos, you know. There are those people who talk of climate, and there are those people who talk of social justice. For the most part, there are some who try and do both. But climate events, which are accelerating, and not just, you know, we tend to also say that climate is a global issue. It happens because of global policy. It happens because of global action. But the action we take on the ground here makes the result, firstly, contributes to that whole global thing. But it's very easy to say, well, you know, one small action that I take may not really change the world, which in a sense is understandable. But what does change is that that climate event, which happens as a result of this action and many others which we are taking individually, is also made worse by the events we are taking individually in our local, hyperlocal areas. So if I, for example, if I talk about a report which has come out this morning in today's paper about land being lost in a particular coastal region of Maharashtra, huge amounts of land as a result of climate change, I would say that sand mining has a part to play as well, especially since that particular area is very close to the area I was attacked in the second time. And I know that despite the attack and the, you know, the kind of awareness that it brought and the fact that sand mining has continued throughout the years since then, that a bridge collapsed, that people died, and still nothing was done to actually stop it over a period of time, it's not just sea level rise, which is a global kind of a thing. But sorry, it's the sand mining in your own area.
Sorry, I was just want to know, what is this bridge collapse and people dying that
you're referring to? There was a place called Mahad, and a bridge collapsed in 2016. Mm-hmm. There were vehicles on the bridge when it collapsed. It was very, very close to the area where I was attacked because of sand mining. They found sand dredgers, not directly under the bridge, but in the vicinity. And then they said, when I said, you know, investigate whether sand mining played a part in this bridge collapse, mm-hmm. the answer was that firstly, there was no investigation. Secondly, mm-hmm. there was just a general statement put out saying, no, sand mining had nothing to do with it. It was just an old bridge. The thing is that unless you investigate, you won't know. And particularly in view of the fact that sand mining goes on at the foot of just about every bridge across every single river, and that the railways have complained, the highways authorities have complained, and sand mining still continued. So there is no basis on which you can say that it was or wasn't a reason. And therefore, in the absence of studies, I cannot tell you that sand mining is responsible for this loss of land, which is happening now. But I can tell you that land has been lost, that studies show that sand mining has taken place there at least for the last 12 years since I was attacked, that numerous complaints which I have made are lying with the district authorities. It continues, and that land has been lost. And that because in a place where you mine sand, and I have backed this up with evidence and photographs to the authorities and the court, in a place where sand is mined, you will see how the banks are being eroded and cut and trees are being lost. You can see that. And so when you say this amount of land has been lost, it seems to me that a study to indicate what is the exact responsibility of sand mining and what is the responsibility of a more general statement like sea level rise needs to be definitely investigated much further. And it's quite alarming that this is not being taken up when people's lives and land and livelihood is at such serious risk.
And maybe since you already, I mean, since you just mentioned some things that you would ideally hope was the case, I could ask you next, what would be your vision for environmental conservation in India in the future, maybe next 50 years or even beyond, if you would want to venture?
Well, you know, we like to say, my generation, old people like me, like to say that we must educate children. And while I don't see that when I see that that's very important, I would like to also think that it's very important that we are open to being educated by children and by young people who are actually at the forefront and leading climate change conversations across the world. It's true across the world, it's true in India. And we have very passionate and committed young people who are actually, some of them, facing even mental health crises, I would say, because they are so passionate about worrying about the world that is being left behind for them through increasing climate events, heat waves, landslides, all kinds of things. So under these circumstances, I think 50 years, they will take over, and they seem to be on track. It's us who need to ensure that we don't wait 50 years when we aren't there to experience it, but these young people who are telling us to be more mindful of the future are heeded in today's policy and today's way of life. You know, it's not just a matter that, well, I'm comfortable, I have the nice house here. It was built using sand, right? Which is a very common thing that I hear. Well, your house was built using sand. Yes, it was, because it was built when, firstly, no one understood, including me, why sand was a scarce resource. Secondly, even today, if I was to build it, there are very few options available to me which are viable, which are feasible. But young people, whether they identify as being pro-environment or even the ones who don't, who work in finance or business or anything at all, or engineering, have a part to play and contribute, even the fashion industry or whatever industry it is, have a part to play and contribute. For example, I can think of civil engineers figuring out ways where you can build not using sand. There are so many solutions to noise pollution which you can use, from distributed sound systems which reduce noise, to using your mobile phone to conduct events and festivals, to having religious and political discourses on TVs or videos, or sorry, radios or mobile phones or anything else. So loudspeakers are technology of 100 years ago, and we are somehow stuck in that era. We are neither going back to the era before loudspeakers, nor are we going forward to the era beyond loudspeakers, which we are already in. Similarly with sand, we are neither going backwards to the era where we all lived in caves, which we should not, and we cannot. But we are also not moving forward to discovering new ways of doing things which will have a better way of life for all. And these ways exist. It's a matter of finding them. So I think that we need to start now. We need to start with my generation, which is the generation which frankly needs education, and move on to the in-between and the younger generations, which I think are the generation which is doing the teaching in current times.
And when it comes to the relationship of conservation with legal structures, boards, committees, authorities that have been set up, given your engagement with them in the course of your work, could you perhaps reflect on this aspect in particular, the role of conservation, the role and place of law in conservation?
Well, law is very important because it's ultimately the only tool you have to create greater enforcement of policies and things that you want to happen. So the law cannot go beyond a policy, which is why we need a law and a policy and a court, all of who work together, and people, most importantly people, because it's the people who elect the governments, it's the governments who enact policy, it's the policy which the courts interpret. So all these things need to go together. And I think, I hope that my campaign has tried to make sure that these stakeholders are all heard. And I think it's very important for me personally, as well as maybe some others who might want to draw some kind of, you know, thought process from it. I won't say lessons, but just a thought process as a way of doing things, that when you don't have a formal NGO and you're not playing to getting fundings, and you're also not kind of don't have this board or committee which is deciding things as being the NGO representing an issue, so to speak, you are much more open to taking on board criticism, which is important to all. And I think, because what happens is that as an NGO, you are representing multiple diverse voices and taking them to the court. And the policymakers are also human beings and also people who suffer from the same issues you're talking about, which makes conservation and court hearings and all the rest of it non-controversial. It has been amazing how many times individual people who form governments and enforcement authorities and political systems have said that they believe what I'm saying to be true and correct, and therefore have supported it in whatever way they could. And that is true for the fact of the police setting up proper systems to enforce the noise laws for various other things. It's been really amazing that people who would have been naturally my adversaries. You know, a guy who joined me on a trip to Mahad when I went back and who had been among those who attacked me, came and told me that, you know, we were against you because we said, who's this woman from Bombay coming here telling us what to do? What does she know? And he said, you know, but I've understood now that what you were saying is true and I would like to join you. So I think these things happen when you don't have a top-down approach, when you're open to everything. The courts too, of course, the courts, like all of us, are citizens of this country. They're made up of judges and officers and lawyers who are all citizens who have the best interest of the country at heart. And in the interest of all of us, conservation is very, very important. So I like to think that, I believe that, I have seen it in operation. Of course, that doesn't mean that there aren't occasions when it's appropriate to take stands which are sometimes more controversial and which do have backlash and where people do criticize you, but that too is part of democracy and we are a democratic country.
So what do you think maybe needs to be done differently going forward?
I think non-confrontationist approaches are the most important. Conversations, trust between stakeholders. I'm very sad to see, and I'm sure Salim Ali would have been very sad to see this kind of, and my father-in-law, Humayun Abdul Ali, would have been very sad to see the kind of discourse that is happening today. You know, where it's either for or against. There's nothing like for or against. There's a huge gray area. In fact, most people fall in the gray area. And I think it's important to be persuasive and to convince them that nobody is against anybody. We are all for the betterment of our own country and for the best possible development. Mm-hmm. I believe that we have been, we as a country believe that the West, who have done the most to aggravate climate change, is a model. Their model of development is something we need to quickly catch up with so that we can start reversing it like they're doing now. But I believe that that approach is leading to further disaster. The West has brought us to this point where we are in this state of systems collapse so far as climate change and its effects go. We don't need to follow them and develop in an identical manner and then spend huge resources in changing that and redoing it. We have some of the most brilliant minds in the world, second to none in this country. We have young people. We have a huge number of young people who are professionally trained in various fields. We have the passion. We have the expertise. We are not lacking anything. We've led the world in so many things, telecom, IT, you know, which we are proud of. There's no reason why we can't lead the world in figuring out better and different ways to develop and show them the way, so that we need to stop buying their obsolete technologies and ideas, which is making them money, and start selling them our vision and our way of doing things, which does require support from everybody, from companies, from government, from politicians, from all of us to do. And a very good example could be the changes that I'm seeing recently in the fashion industry, you know, for example, where the fashion industry and young people are talking of being proud of using recycled materials, mm-hmm. you know. So if we can see this kind of input in our daily lives, from the whole thing of saying don't do this to saying do this, you know, and here's how, I think we'll see the change.
Yeah, I think you've already answered a bit of the last question that I had for you, which was how you foresee the future of wild species and spaces in India and what gives you hope and what gives you worry. I think you've already addressed a bit of at least the hope aspect, but if you want to delve a little deeper into it and maybe what you think will actually end up happening as opposed to what you would ideally envision.
Well, you know, I think the question, I'd just like to rephrase a bit, because humanity has existed for a very small portion of the Earth's existence, if you look historically. Mm-hmm. We've had many species which have become extinct. The dinosaurs come immediately to mind. And the world has continued. Maybe they have changed. The other species have taken over. They have done it. So I don't have long-term worries about the world, the earth in general. Mm-hmm. I think it will exist, whatever happens. But we have unprecedented species loss at this moment. Of the species we know in our existence as human beings on this earth. And if new species evolve, we don't know what will be our interaction with those species. We don't know what kind of world we will live in, what kind of climate we will live in. So it's impossible to answer the question, except that in the long term, the world will exist. How, in what form it will exist, depends very much on the action we take now. And I remain hopeful. Of course, there's a lot of reasons. We hear doom and gloom all around us all the time. And there's good cause for it, because we aren't heading in good directions the way, if we just keep on the way we are. But I do believe that our young people feel very strongly and are making the changes required. And there's a tipping point to everything. You know, if you take, say, for example, the women's right to vote as a very random, it seemed impossible, right? And it wasn't that long ago that it seemed impossible. But today you can't even imagine. In fact, countries where women are not allowed to vote, you know, it's like, so everyone, women, it's taken for granted that women vote and women work and women do all kinds of things which people thought were not women's role at all. So similarly, we need that kind of push. And I think it's a question of how soon we reach that tipping point. And therefore, it's all hands on deck. We need every single voice, because that is not going to happen because you said something or I said something or somebody else said something. It'll happen when that voice reaches that tipping point where we have the infrastructure in place to make this happen. At that point, what will be the state of our world? I don't know. But whatever the state of our world will be, I think we'll have to take it from that point on, as some of us are already doing and some of us are not.
Is there anything else that you would like to add that you think we have not covered or touched upon so far before we wind up?
I think the role of women, perhaps, you know, mm-hmm. that we hear again and again how climate change, in fact, again, this is a very recent discourse, that mm-hmm. climate change affects women disproportionately. Yes. The United Nations has said that more women die in climate events for various reasons. They're not taught how to swim. There are more women are displaced. They can't go anywhere for jobs like men can. Still, they have the primary burden of family care. They are primarily responsible for crops and farming, mm-hmm. and which is a hugely impacted sector. So I think I talked of gender and voting, but mm-hmm. when women come on board, the world does change. And women are 50% of the world. Mm-hmm. So as happened with the voting issue, it was in the interest of men not to educate them, but women led the way and educated them. I think in the climate discourse, women are leading the way also in many ways, because mm-hmm. they are most impacted. Although policy change typically has not been something that is given to them, women have had to fight for these rights. But I think we are seeing it happen. And I have a lot of faith in women and the youth.
How has their engagement been in when it comes to noise pollution and sand mining?
Sand mining has been more difficult for them because the mm-hmm. men have restrained them from speaking to a mm-hmm. large extent. But still, there has been a fast which was conducted in Kerala for so many years by a woman. There have been instances. Noise pollution, I've had slum dwellers call me and say, my husband doesn't know I'm calling you, so I'm calling from a payphone and I can't call the police because I can't risk them calling back and my husband finding out. So women have special problems of their own. But nevertheless, they have led the way in both these issues in many, many ways, because they are the ones who suffer the most. And they are the ones who, once they start, like I did, you know, you could say, when I was attacked, I became more determined. When they suffer the effects of climate change, they wake up and they rise up. The Chipko movement was initiated by women in, you know, in Uttarakhand and Reni, and it's been emulated all over the world, often by women. So I think women and you are the key.
And personally for you as a woman, how has it been in your journey? If you could maybe just reflect a little on that as well.
Well, I have faced some of these issues too, I have to say, in the larger world. But fortunately, my family has been extremely supportive. I mean, not every family in the world would allow you to go and get beaten up a second time by sand miners. But they have done that. I had young children, I've said that. My children helped me. So family is very important all around. And women supporting women is very important. I think mentoring other women, because women don't have role models, enough role models in this space. We look at men and men tell us what to do. And when we don't toe their line, they tell us how we are wrong. And sometimes they tell us how stupid we are. So I think we have to have people who are telling us that we have a right to think of things differently from a different point of view. And that what the men are telling us is sometimes right, but is sometimes not. And that we have a right to disagree, as is in every sector.
Yes. Okay. Is there anything else, or would you like to conclude the interview now?
I think that was pretty comprehensive, right?
Okay, then I'll just stop the recording. But thank you once again for agreeing to be a part of the project.
Not at all. Very happy to be there.